Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Dr. Guy's Monday Night Gumbo with your host, Dr. Tanisha Guy, licensed professional counselor, and co-host Andrea Wise Brown, life strategist and licensed professional counselor, and Sean the Realist. Dr. Guy Monday Night Gumbo and associates take no responsibility for the opinions or statements made by talk show hosts or their guests. Statements or show topics are not necessarily the beliefs of the show host. Dr. Guy Monday Night Gumbo is not intended to be therapy, but the sole purpose is to disseminate information, increase dialogue across ages, religious preference, gender, and sexual orientation. Don't forget to tune in every week to Dr. Guy's Monday Night Gumbo.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Dr. Guy's Monday Night Gumbo. Is it me, or is the year already flying by? And so today is April the 20th, and I feel like we were just kind of celebrating the new year. But, again, I digress. And so I am so delighted to go ahead and get into this topic because I think this is a pressing issue for so many Americans. And so I'm going to go ahead and start off by introducing our guest for this evening. And our guest is Dr. Malik Rahim, and I'm going to tell you guys a little bit about him. He's a national certified counselor. He's a licensed and I'll have to ask him because he practices in California, so his license is a little bit different. But I believe he's a licensed professional counselor, a licensed clinical professional counselor. He's currently an assistant professor in the Counselor Education and Rehabilitation Department of California State University in Fresno. And as an educator, he attempts to ensure that his students are multiculturally competent counselors and social justice advocates. And so I'm bringing him on the show tonight because he talks a lot about multiculturalism and making sure that future counselors and counselor educators are culturally competent. And while doing that, he focuses a lot, or he talks about diversity and so how it impacts everyone, but in particular African Americans. And so he is our guest this evening. And so thank you so much for joining us tonight, Dr. Rahim.
Thank you for having me, Dr. Guy.
And everybody knows our co-host, Sean the Realist. Hey, Sean.
How you all doing tonight? I'm really excited about the topic.
Okay. So we are really just going to go ahead and jump right into tonight's topic. And so our topic is Divided States of America, Racism in 2015. And so I'm going to give you both an opportunity. Just from the topic, Divided States of America, how do you guys feel about that topic?
I'd go first, I guess. Well, the way I look at it is that racism has manifested itself into more subtle and covert forms called microaggressions. In the past, the racism was very overt in your face, and you kind of knew the person's intentions. But now with the covert microaggressions, I feel that that causes more of a mental health strain on the person that feels they're under attack, because the thing is that there's no clear-cut, quote-unquote, evidence of what the person is doing. So a lot of times when you try to tell people about what their experiences are, they'll say something like, don't be so sensitive, or you're thinking too much, or they're trying to give you another explanation, alternative explanation on what possibly can be going on. So it usually had a person rethinking themselves and kind of get the feeling that they're losing their mind, because they kind of know what they're feeling. They kind of know what the person did and said. But it's so covert that it's usually easily explained off. So I think that causes more of a mental health strain in the Black community today than it did back in when racism was more overt.
Mm-hmm. All right. Sean, what do you think about our topic tonight? Just the title itself, Divided States of America.
Well, I mean, you know, primarily I always approach everything from a business or a financial standpoint, and a lot of times it's really more of a business issue. And translating the old guard from a power base or structure to a younger guard. Like, lot of racism is taught, but it's still more prevalent in, you know, the generation of the baby boomers, and they do control a lot of the wealth in the country still. So they are still some decision makers. You know, you have to be a certain age to run for president. When you are in those political offices, you do take those biases with you as well. And, you know, not necessarily to draw lines, but, you know, a lot of times, you know, if we talk about just a black experience, black people are just as racist as everybody else. A lot of times they tend to segregate themselves and, well, I don't like, you know, white people. I don't trust Asians. You know, the Hispanics don't listen to us and respect us like white people. So, you know, a lot of times it's just people that draw a fence around themselves as well as other groups of people.
So for you, the whole idea behind racism in America in 2015, you're saying, what, that everybody is just has the capacity to be racist, and you don't think that there's more racism that's specified or geared towards people of color?
Not at all. I mean, I think it's everywhere. It's not a racism isn't a people of color topic. Like, even if you look at the gay and lesbian movement, it mirrors the black struggle, like the marching. Everything that the gay and lesbians did is pretty much the model that the black people did in the 60s.
Can I make a comment real quick?
Go ahead.
No due respect, Sean the Realist. I think one of the things that when I teach my students, I think the first thing that we have to do is when we make any type of assessment is to define what we're talking about, especially when it's come to an abstract term like racism. And what a lot of people do is confuse racism with prejudice or discrimination. Racism, by the true sociological term, is about power and privilege. So it's like no people of color have that power or privilege. Now, can black people be prejudiced? Sure. Can Asian people be prejudiced? Can Latinos be prejudiced? Sure. They can be prejudiced. Can they discriminate? Sure. But can they be racist? That's a totally different story, because they don't have the power to institute structures and laws that's going to keep people back. So it's like when you look at the true definition of racism, a lot of times people get confused on what racism is and what prejudice and discrimination is.
Well, I'm still going to say that it's not a racist issue. It's a financial issue. It's not a black people thing. It's a poor people thing. You know, the majority of people on welfare are Caucasian.
Going back to...
That's true.
That is a true statement, but it's the reason why there are more Caucasians on public assistance is because by numbers, they're still considered the majority group. So there are more Caucasians than there are at this point of another minority group, which we do believe is changing according to current statistics. By 2026, the Hispanic culture is going to be the largest group, known as the majority and no longer as the minority. But going back to the idea that racism it's not about racism, but it's about power, or I guess is what you're saying, several years ago, and I'm sure people still teach from it today. When I was teaching, I taught the multicultural course, and every semester I made a point of having the students read an article called White Privilege, Unpacking the Invisible Backpack by Peggy McIntosh. And it talks about this whole idea about white privilege, and so, which is what Dr. Raheem was making reference to. When you talk about racism or an individual ability to be a racist, one first has to be part of that dominant culture or have the ability to have the power to do so. Everybody, I'm sure, whether they want to admit it or not, there are some prejudice that individuals have, whether it's for a group or particular topic or something like that. But the whole idea behind racism, you're saying, Sean, that you don't think that it exists and that it's about color.
Well, I'm saying it's based more on finance than it used to be.
Okay.
Well, to me, it's this country. This country is built on race. And unfortunately, I don't feel that's going to ever change. I mean, they might throw smoke screens and start talking about poor and poverty, but when you break it all down, is about black and white, or more specifically about black and non-black. Because the wealth in this country was created through the transatlantic slave trade and through the years of forced slavery by, and then the years of the Jim Crow laws and the black codes that were suffered through by the black Americans. And then about the new so-called Jim Crow era with the prison population system being an economic power. It's like the thing about it is, if you understand white supremacy and racism, everything starts off at race, and then everything else is just a symptom, a systematic thing that's just built off that. So even if you're talking about economics, you still got to deal with the foundation of race and racism in this country. So it's like, the thing is, it's like, even a poor white person has more privilege and more access to things than a middle-class black person. So it's like, the thing is that even if you try to look at it through economics, so it's like, it's still the foundation of this country is about race. So all the interactions is about race.
Mm-hmm. I want to go. Sean, were you going to make a comment?
Well, yeah, definitely. I think that, you know, your statement about poor white people having more access to things than a middle-class black family, I would think that's an opinion until you can show me some facts. The country itself has been built on free labor, and I do agree with that. But initially it was the Indians, and then it was the Africans. And we've had, you know, the Irish, you know, the Chinese, you know, when they built the railroads. Like, it's always been a country built on some type of free labor. Even if we talk about now, the undocumented Hispanics that work in fields, it's always about free labor. It's always about the economics.
But that's all of them are race. All of them are also race-based. And so what you're trying to do is you're trying to dilute the variable race, but race is fair. And then, again, you got to look at it like this also. When the whole University of Chicago, University of Harvard University, they did studies where they showed that white males have more privilege if they have a black male that has a felony and a white male that has a felony. A white male that has a high school diploma has more access to certain jobs than a black male that has a bachelor's degree. There are studies out there. So if I knew I was going to get into this discussion, I would bring the exact articles, but you can easily look them up. These were done by economic professors. So you won't think they're sociologists or psychologists. They were done by economic professors, where they show that, you know, there's studies where they had two people going to apply for a job, a white male and a black male, and they had the exact same credentials with the exception of a felony. And in actuality, the white male had the felony, not the black male. And 85% of the time, the white male was hired. So it's like, there are studies out there that show, even if you try to break it down to economics, it's still race-based.
We do have a caller, and so we're going to go to the phone line, and then we're going to come back with some more of you guys' comments on this topic. Let's see, 661, you're on the air.
Hey, you guys should know my number by now. This is Joe Neckbone. How you doing?
Hey, Joe Neckbone.
Hey, I'm glad that the brother mentioned white supremacy, because ultimately this is what it all rolls up to. I mean, racism is a component of it, and a large component of it, but it all rolls up to the general attitude and focus of white supremacy within this country and within the world. And so I understand where Sean's coming from. I don't agree with what he's saying. I understand where he's coming from, but he needs to look at the bigger picture, which is, you know, patterns and practices of maintaining power via white supremacy. So you can't take that part out of it. You can't just look at one small piece and try and define the whole picture by the small piece. You have to look at it against the greater landscape of white supremacy. So that's all I'm going to say, and then you put me on mute.
Thanks, Joe Neckbone. Mm-hmm. Sean, did you want to respond back to that comment?
Well, I mean, like I said, I'm unaware of the studies. you know, I grew up in rural South Carolina, you know, where the last state to take down the Confederate flag from the state house.
Mm-hmm.
So I am well versed in white supremacy and the Ku Klux Klan and all of those things. So I think I have a pretty fair perspective. Maybe some of the gentlemen disagree, but, you know, I still think it's an economical thing. I think it's more of a generational thing. Whenever you look at the younger people, it is not really so much an issue with them. When I talk to older people, they are more the ones to say, well, my daughter's not going to marry a white man, you know, or, you know, when I have those encounters, that's what I come across. So, you know, whether the decision makers are, you know, Caucasian, you know, we're in a economy where you can kind of create your own situation. I think that's one of the wonderful things that we have going on in this country. And that's why a lot of people want to immigrate. So, like, I still think it goes back to the economics, whether, you know, we have Hispanic immigrants or African immigrants or Pakistan immigrants. It's still the country's based off of free labor. And it doesn't matter what group you fall into.
I have a question for you two. You, both of you all are educated African-American men. And I'm very curious to know what your experience is like as an educated African-American man, because I know for a fact that my experience is different from yours as a African-American woman. And so I just want to know, for you, what are your experiences? Have you ever come across a situation that you knew you were being discriminated against and the premise of it was so because of your skin color?
I'd like to defer to the doctor, of course.
Of course. Thank you. yes, there have been numerous occasions of the fact that I've been discriminated because of my race. Just because I have a doctorate doesn't change the fact that I'm still a black Muslim man. And in a lot of people's eyes, that would never change. I mean, now the thing, I have a doctor, gives me a little bit more access, a little bit more privilege than your average black male, but it doesn't change the fact that I'm who I was born as, a black man.
Mm-hmm.
If you want me to give specific examples, I can, but yes, I mean, it's like I still get pulled over by the police. I still get followed in stores. I still have a hard time sometimes getting services the same way I would if I was probably white. So it's like, yeah, it's definitely a lot of occasions where the color of my skin trumps the fact that I have a doctorate.
Sean, what about you? Being from South Carolina and have lived in other states.
Well, you know, I've always had a interaction with the police department in one capacity or another. One of the more, challenging situations, I was in high school, I had a orange Volkswagen Bug. I always liked some Volkswagens. So my friends and I went out of town to hang out with another one of my friends that played football. Small town. Actually, some of Michelle Obama's parents are from there. Well, relatives anyway. So, you know, I'm at the stoplight, it's me, you know, three of my friends, you know, I guess the car is packed because of the Bug, it's four of us. I noticed there's a police car behind me at the intersection, there's one to my left and one in front of me, so the light turns green, I go to accelerate, the cop stops in front of me, the one comes from the intersection, boxes me in, everybody jumps out with shotguns and points them at us, and, you know, wants us to get out of the car. We get out of the car, and their excuse was they had a car reported that was stolen that matched the description of my vehicle. And I was like, oh, someone stole an orange Volkswagen Bug. So,
what year was this?
high school, 1990.
We'll say 91.
Oh, but it wasn't because of economics?
Well, not in that scenario, you know.
Because the only thing that you look for is a Volkswagen Bug, and not disrespecting anyone who owns a Volkswagen Bug, But they look at that as being that you had to be definitely poor, not black.
Well, in hindsight, it may not have necessarily been my skin tone, but perhaps where I was coming from that I was not aware of at the time.
Because you were poor.
Well, I was someplace that they might have been doing other things than being poor. So, there was not a probable cause, but if in hindsight, you know, some of the people I was affiliated with might have been doing some other things that I wasn't aware of at the time. But, you know, there wasn't probable cause. You know, there was no report of a stolen vehicle, basically, what I'm saying. So,
right. So what I'm saying is, it's like that had nothing to do with your race. It had to do with your economics.
If I wouldn't have been in the section of town that was not economically viable and perhaps people had pursued other measures to make income, that is possible.
Okay. There was a time when I moved out here to Fresno. When I first moved out here from Fresno, from Chicago, I didn't own a car. And my son and I used to walk to the Walmart to get, you know, our groceries, and we'd be walking back. And so one day we were walking back, and where I stay in Fresno, I guess you could say is the better, quote unquote, better part of town. And my son and I, we're walking, and a police car pulls up. Fresno Finest pulls up and throws on his little lights and pulls us over and asks us for ID. Now, like I said, we just moved out here, so I still have my Illinois ID. So I, you know, I'm asking, what is this for? He said, I just want to see your ID. So I show him my ID, and, you know, everyone that has any kind of at least a sixth grade education would know that Illinois is one of the 48 continuous states. So he looks at the Illinois license, he says, do you have anything that's government issue? Right? Now, I know what he intended to mean. Do I have anything that says California, where I'm from, where I'm going to in California? I said, no, I just moved out here from Chicago. And I explained everything to him. Now, he didn't stop me because I'm poor. I make over $70,000 a year. He didn't stop me because I'm poor. He didn't stop me because of economics. He stopped my son and I because we're black.
We don't know what he might have heard on the radio. Perhaps there was somebody that you fit a description
like
of. Maybe
said,
there was somebody in the neighborhood prior. You know,
it's nobody in Fresno as sexy as I am. So there ain't no way he gave that kind of description. There's no way they gave that kind of description that it fit me, right? Because it's like the only other person that as sexy as I am has passed away, and that's Gerald Levert. So, the point I'm trying to make is this. Just like I tell my students, don't try to look for the invisible monkey. Don't try to look for the invisible monkey. Attack the elephant in the room first. So if you're having an issue with one of your clients, if you're a counselor and you're not feeling that you have a connection with your client, attack the issue at hand first. Get rid of the obvious. Eliminate the obvious before you start looking for the invisible monkey. And what I mean by that is this. If you're a male and your client's a female, address that and make sure that that's not the reason you two not connect. Maybe that's an issue. If you're black and she's white, or she's white and you're black, if you're Latino, if you're Asian, whatever, attack and get rid of the obvious first. Don't look for the invisible monkey in the room until you eliminate the obvious. Don't be looking for the little bitty maybe this, maybe that, maybe this. No, eliminate the obvious first. And that's what I would encourage everyone to do, is to eliminate the obvious. It ain't all the time it's going to be the obvious. But that should be the first thing that should clear your head. And once you understand that it's not that anymore, then you can start looking for the invisible monkey.
Speaking of the obvious, Sean, I'm going to, you know, pose this question to you because it's good old South Carolina. How do you explain, the Walter Scott shootings? Now, mind you, I'm not saying that that every occurrence that takes place with someone African-American and someone Caucasian is racism or is discrimination. I'm not saying that because, obviously, I don't know. I'm not in their shoes. But in this particular instance, where it was caught on tape, and from the naked eye, and I'm just going off of what my two eyes saw, I saw a gentleman running away from an officer. I don't know what took place before he ran away. I don't know if he made a threat, or obviously none of us do, but from the looks of the video, this gentleman was fleeing the scene and the officer. And I wish if we have any police officers or anyone who may be more familiar with protocol for officers, if you're listening, I do want you to answer this question because I'm not sure. And so my question is, what is the protocol when arresting a perp if he is running away? I don't know what it is, but I would like to know what is the official protocol if there is no perceived danger. In this video, in South Carolina, a white officer shoots an African-American man in the back, not once, not twice, but eight times. How is that shooting explained as justifiable? And Sean's words.
I reached out to some of my, you know, contacts in South Carolina to try and get some more clarity. And from what I heard, and it may be official or unofficial, this gentleman had been having issues with child support, and every time he would, you know, fall behind, he would get locked up and lose his job, and that was kind of why he was running, because he was trying to avoid that situation again. I do have quite a few friends who are police officers, and we do have these conversations from time to time. I do get to hear about a lot of funny things, like, you know, drunk people jumping off balconies naked, but, like, this wasn't one of those things. So normally there is a procedure of escalation depending on the confrontation.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we might go from, you know, baton, mace, gun, depending on, you know, what the threat level or taser in that regard. This particular gentleman is, you know, in his situation because he didn't follow any of the protocols that I'm aware of. And you do have those people who, you know, and it kind of speaks to some of the hiring practices we have. You know, I do have actually one friend who is a police officer that will go nameless that has had failed the psychological evaluation twice, but, he knew somebody, so he got on. So, and then you do have the people who are in the military. So we get to more of a military state than actually, you know, a friendly police state. So, you know, I don't really have any excuse for that officer. I've always heard of those things happening in South Carolina, but, you know, with technology being what it is now, I guess we actually were able to physically see.
Okay. So your response to that is that was potentially maybe an incident of racism. Possibly.
I don't know if it was racism or just plain an abuse of power. I mean, we may look at it as racism because of what occurred, but, you know, like, he just may be, you know, one of those people that abuses his power. I mean, like, that those situations are out there as well. So, you know, police is a very difficult job to have. And, you know, mm-hmm. I have seen some of the training videos that they watch, and,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's a lot that goes into being able to go into a traffic stop or, you know, having these confrontations with people. And, you know, a lot of them are a little bit more on edge and more quickly to feel like, well, I'm going to go home. So I'd rather be judged by a jury than carried by pallbearers.
Okay. Don't get me wrong. I am by no means anti-police. By no means am I, because if something happens to me, if someone breaks into my house, the first thing I'm going to do is call the police. Maybe that's the second thing I'm going to do after I grab what's in my nightstand, and then I'm going to call the police. But I believe that you should uphold the law and definitely respect police officers. So by no means am I saying that there's a problem with all police officers, but it is clear in that video that there was an unjustified shooting. Let's say this guy was back on child support and he had fled numerous times. I don't know if that was the protocol for someone fleeing multiple times for child support is to get 8 shots in the back. So,
I'm not condoning that at all. I just was giving – I know a lot of people wanted to know why he ran. I was just giving what I had heard why he ran. That's all.
Okay. And that
– Can I ask
Dr. Rahim?
Because something is really confusing me. So you heard why he ran, but you don't want to call it racism. Because that would be speculation. But nobody really know why he ran. So everybody just speculating on why he ran. I mean, because I've heard, because see, this is the funny thing that the media does. You got to be very careful with the media. Because the media has you believing that the person who's really innocent is guilty, and the person who's guilty is innocent. So the thing is this, it's a pattern that's been happening every single time that these brothers and sisters have been getting killed by the police, that all of a sudden you get this big thing about their criminal record. The brother who got choked out in New York, right? Oh, well, he was selling loose cigarettes, and he's been doing that on a regular basis. Oh, then with the Mike Brown thing, oh, well, you know, here's this tape of him possibly robbing this store and strong-arm this man. It's like all of a sudden there's all these things where, like, now you're going to make the police look like they're justified in doing the things that they've done. So just like now they're trying to say, oh, well, he was behind on child support and there was a warrant on his arrest. I've also heard that there was no warrant for his arrest and there was no issue of child support. So the thing is, like, it's easy to speculate on that, but like I said, eliminating the obvious is not easy to say, well, this was definitely probably a case of racial bias. Because of the stereotypical image that the black man holds in America, you can talk all day long about economics and free labor markets. There has never in this country been a system set up like slavery. The Chinese building a railroad, it was a lot of Africans building that railroad too. The Irish coming over here, they didn't do free labor. They did cheap labor. They didn't do free labor. And even before the Chinese and the Irish, America was a power because of the years, the centuries of free labor they got from the Africans. So the thing about it is like, the thing is this. If you truly a realist, like your name says, Sean the Realist, be real and be able to accept the fact that racism is alive and well and powerful. It didn't disappear and all of a sudden become, but we're all equal except economic. No. Racism exists. When you have a white cop shoot a black man, like I said, the first thing you really need to eliminate is the fact that there's no biases. And everybody have a bias. There is no police officer in the country would have told you that he was justified for shooting that man in the back 8 times.
Now, you guys, even though we're talking about the recent shooting in South Carolina, there are more shootings that are even more recent than that one. And so the NAACP posted a stat and said from 1999 to 2014, there were 76 unjustified killings of black men by police officers. And those were unjustified killings. And so what we're talking about is not something that was a happenstance. It was just a single occurrence that took place, and we don't understand the entire story. We're talking about a series of events of black men who have been killed and who are unarmed, and it was unjustified, and it was by white officers. And so I think that brings some alarm, or at least it should bring some alarm. Again, this is not to say that all police officers are bad police officers. There are definitely some good officers that do what they are supposed to do. But in like any profession, in my field, there are definitely some unethical counselors. I'm not an unethical counselor, but I know that to be true, that even though their duty is to protect the clients that they serve, it doesn't always happen. And so as a result, if I know that there are unethical professionals in my field, then I have to believe that there are unethical professionals in other fields, and
right,
the police are not
Guy,
above the law.
Mm-hmm. Right, but Dr. Guy, this is the difference. Using counselors, we are bound to eliminate them. We're gatekeepers.
Mm-hmm.
We're bound to eliminate them by our code of ethics.
Mm-hmm.
This young man was shot in the back 8 times, and then his other officer came and helped him, try to help him cover it up. Now, see, you said the NAACP said there were 76
mm-hmm.
unjustifiable killings. The sad thing about it is when I was growing up on the south side of Chicago, and I used to believe all people making this stuff up, I wish people would stop talking about this, people would stop saying this, but it was always the same script. They found the weapon on the guy had a weapon, the guy did a weapon, made a menacing move, and then that's why the cop shot him and was justified. If there was no video of that gentleman getting shot 8 times, you would have had the same script. And I'm not saying that every single time that there's a shooting and all of a sudden a gun or a weapon mysteriously appeared that they've been planted. I'm not saying that at all. But I'm saying that you got to also now be skeptical. You got to be skeptical. You saw it right there. All the times that people were saying this. I've heard people say this. I've heard my great uncle say it. I heard my mom say it. I heard my brother's friend say it. I heard my friend say it. And all the time in the back of my head, I'll be like, yeah, right. When I was in the Marine Corps, I hear people saying this, and I'll be thinking, well, yeah, right. Please also don't do that. But then you have it on tape. You have it on tape where they were sitting there changing the crime scene before anyone came.
Mm-hmm.
So now it makes me wonder, like, how often does that happen? Because the thing is, I've heard so many people say, oh, but there are good cops out there. Where are they? Because the thing about it is like, they got this blue code where they all protect each other. Unlike counselors, the thing is, if there's a counselor, if I find out that a counselor is having sex with one of his patients, I'm going to take him to the ethical board. I'm not going to sit there and say, well, you know, they consented. No, I'm going to take him to the ethical board. This is an issue.
But
I agree with you.
I agree that we do have that obligation to report someone in the field that is practicing unethically. But in defense, we don't have a job that requires someone else to watch our back to make sure that we make it home at night. And so I think that changes loyalty. And I'm not saying that it's right, but at the end of the day, I do not have a job. And I won't say I don't have a job that puts my life in danger, because sometimes doing what we do can be dangerous. But
yeah.
I don't go out daily to serve and protect. And so I do respect and I appreciate officers that do that every day, that put their lives on the line. And so maybe there is that loyalty to this other person that they work with, again, because this is the person that has to watch your back the next day and vice versa. I'm not condoning it by no means, but I'm saying I think I understand that process. It's unfortunate
right.
that it's taken place, but I think I understand that a little bit better.
I have a hard time cool. understanding that. And the reason I say I have a hard time understanding that is this. If you get rid of the bad apples, the people who are going to be looking out for your back are going to be good apples. There have been reports that police commissioners, I forgot what city it was, but a police commissioner got pulled over by his officer because he's black. He's black. The police officer was white. They pulled him over, and they harassed him. But they have the job to serve and protect, and they cover stuff up. So my thing is if in any profession, if you really truly want your profession to be upstanding, you're going to clean up the bad apples. So the people who are going to be protecting you are going to be the other people who are going to take a stand and say, enough is enough. The guy who got out there and started helping, the black officer who got out there and started helping planning the weapons and moving the taser gun, that officer to me is just as guilty, if not more guilty, than the officer who shot.
Mm-hmm.
Because I could, in my mind, I could say, well, maybe this happened, maybe that happened, that's why he shot. Maybe he just panicked and the guy ran and he just shot, you know, instinct. It was a bit of calm after the brother is dead. They handcuffed the brother. They start getting the weapons and moving over there. They start getting their story together. What you looking out for me to make sure I don't get arrested? You're not looking out for me to make sure I don't get shot. You shot this man. This man is dead. Now you make a conscientious effort to make sure you cover up stuff.
Uh-huh. All right.
So, real quick, being from South Carolina, you know, I've always heard of those stories as well. You know, and even from some of my friends who are police officers, they tell me that, you know, it may be standard procedure for them to keep a weapon with no serial number just in case those situations occur. But, you know, when you're speaking, I think it comes from a good place ideologically. But, you know, when you look at the candidate pool, who's willing to be a police officer, what the pay is, you know, it's a difficult job to create that environment. You know, there are a lot of people who are police officers because they want the power. You know, they want to police. You know, they don't have anything else to do. They come back from the military. So, I mean, I understand your points, but, you know, it comes from a good place, but, like, practically I don't know how well that works. You know, when I talk to my friends who are police officers, they tell me the best way not to be in those situations is not to interact with them. You know, and say, for instance, you being new in Fresno with your son, that was new to that police officer. That didn't fit in. You talk about eliminating the obvious. You were pretty much the same thing that you speak of. He was eliminating the obvious. You were new. You weren't something that he was accustomed to seeing, so he wanted to investigate. So, you know, I think that we still have to have an open mind. These still are people. These are still situations that are fluid and ongoing. You know, just like this gentleman had this situation on Monday, you know, for all intents and purposes, the black cop could have the situation on Thursday, and that's how they look at it. That's why we talk about the blue line. That's what Dr. Guy was talking about. Well, I can't sit here and judge you because it might happen to me 2 days from now. So they all stick together. I get it. But is it right? Not necessarily. But, you know, I don't necessarily know that the black cop knew specifically what happened. You know, he just was adhering to the morals and mores of that particular industry, like you talked about for your industry with not having sex with a patient. Like, you have certain code of ethics that you talked about, whether they be spoken or unspoken in any industry.
Right. But if I walk into a doctor's office and I see a patient laying there naked, and I'm not going to, you know, take the condom and throw it away so it won't be no evidence. Right.
Because there's no repercussions of you,
but
you
that's,
dying.
But that's basically what he did. That's basically what he did.
What are the repercussions for him not doing it?
The repercussions of him not doing it is getting rid of people that's in his line of field. It's his occupation. The thing about it is that I get so tired of people saying that these officers got to look out for each other's back. And the reason I say that is this. Because the thing about it is once you're a black officer, you out of that uniform, you become a black man too. So the thing about it is the problem coming in, a lot of these officers think that they are above the law. You become a potential target too. So the thing about it is you among all people should want to get rid of all the bad officers. The thing about it is this. If there's a fluctuation of counselors doing harm to clients, I am not going to sit back and just say, well, they got to look out for me too. I don't want to lose my license. So I'm not going to say nothing about them. No, I'm going to make sure that my field, my occupation is looked on in a positive light from the public. If you really going to be serve and protect, the thing about it is this. If you're going to serve and protect, there's no reason that people should be scared of you when you come approach.
Dr. Raheem, I want to ask you a question based on that last comment that you said, that no one should be afraid of you if you're approaching. And, Sean, I want you to think about this one too. But specifically, I have a neighbor, and she has a 13-year-old son. And several times we've had conversations about being black in Texas. And so more specifically now, because of so many of the occurrences with the police incidents. And so she said that she is obviously fearful for her son. Safety, but she's teaching him that if he ever has any encounter with an officer, for him to do exactly what he says, to put his hands up in front of him, to not say anything, and if they're arresting him, to not fight it, not dispute it, just allow them to arrest him, even if he knows it's not something that he did, but allow himself to get arrested so that he can make it to the police station and then obviously call her and get released. You are the father of a son, and so are there things specifically that you're teaching your son about the police? Because obviously you and I are both from Chicago, which now they're calling Chirac, and we do know that there were still shootings several years ago. But I wasn't taught to fear the police. Like, I was taught that if something happened and I was out, to run to the first police officer. And so I'm wondering now, in 2015, are African-American parents teaching their children, more specifically their sons, something different about the police?
That was for me?
Yeah, because Sean doesn't have any kids.
Oh. Unfortunately, many African-American parents, the right of black malehood, black masculinity, and the right of passage for men, is to teach them how to interact with the police.
So there is specific teachings that
Yes, so in many homes, that is a thing that happens, that they teach them how you're supposed to interact with the police.
Now, Sean, obviously you don't have kids. Do you think that more parents, and again, because I've had this conversation with more than one of my friends who has male children, Sean, do you think that's a result of them fearing the police because obviously there is some unjustified shootings that are taking place against black men, or do you think that, they're just afraid because they're watching too much news?
Well, I mean, one thing I can agree with the doctor is this is nothing new. This has always happened, There's always been a healthy mistrust of authority in the black community because the same people that were police officers were the same people that come back with their robes and hoods on the next night. So, it is more about that fear that I'm not going to make it to the police station. And actually, I'm not sure if you all, being from Chicago, I read recently there was a federal lawsuit about a black site that was pretty much well known. Once people were arrested, many times they were taken to the black site and pretty much beaten. And that was a finding from the FBI Department of Justice, I won't say, in the past couple of months, and they've pretty much allegedly closed the site down. I think that, when we talk about propaganda and TV, if you're getting arrested, just get arrested. There's nothing good you're not going to convince the cop not to arrest you. He doesn't want to hear about your rights, and get arrested, go through the process, and just come out on the other side. I mean, I think that initial fear of the conversation or the initial fear of being arrested is what causes people to run and fight back. But, I want you to be cognizant and have a healthy respect. I've had a situation, I was coming back from Atlanta to New Orleans. My friend and myself, there was a police officer following. He kept getting in my blind spot, so he pulled me over and said I was swerving. He called his called back up. It was me and my friend, and the guy had the K-9 unit, and so he just separated us and they questioned us. But being I'm a little well versed in police, the radio radio, I understood that the dispatch said we were all fine. And, I was striking up a conversation with a K-9 guy. And, I was like, hey, why are we still here? He's like, hey, well, y'all ain't got cleared yet. I was like, no, we got cleared 10 minutes ago. And then he went and told his partner, hey, not these guys, let them go. So, it's just really about being about cognizant and being aware. You're not going to win those confrontations, so don't even start them.
And because you both are saying that, I'm wondering, are other groups telling their kids to be cognizant of being approached by police officers? again, if you're Hispanic, if you're Asian, if you're Caucasian, like, are these parents weary that their child or loved one could be mistakenly shot because the cell phone that they pulled out their pocket was mistaken for a gun? Like, again, I'm wondering if that's very specific to the African-American culture or minorities in general.
I think being we're moving toward a police state, I just think it's everybody. You know, I think it would be foolish not to advise your children in that capacity because, you know, anytime you have an interaction with the police, it's not because they like you. It's because they're investigating. They think something. So all of those situations are going to start out as accusatory. You know, it's how much you cooperate, how you cooperate. You know, you don't have to do but so much, but if he wants to arrest you, then you'll have your day in court. And, you know, that's pretty much the way that I've seen those interactions go. You know, anytime you're hostile or, you know, they can perceive you as a threat, they treat you like a threat.
I'm glad you used that word, that they perceive you as a threat. The fact that some individuals, in particular African-American men, are, I don't know, let's say, you know, 6 feet or, you know, 5'11 or something like that, muscular build, that's, can you be perceived a threat just because of your just general stature? So there, I think there are some times where African-American men have been profiled not because they were, you know, driving with a busted taillight or swerved across the lanes, or but solely because they were driving. They were African-Americans, and if they were in a luxury vehicle, then that gave them probable cause. So when we have instances that occur like that, again, can we still say that it's not about racism, but it's more about economics?
Well, I mean, I think we all do it, whether you're walking to your car and you see five teenagers with hoodies on and tattoos. You're cognizant of where they're at. It's not that they're bad people. It's just being aware of your surroundings. You know, if it's a large black man, if it's a large Hispanic guy, you know, if it's a guy that's got a tattoo in his head, you know, he may not, he may be a good person, but you're still cognizant of him.
Oh, okay. Dr. Raheem?
Yeah.
Any thoughts on that? That they could be perceived or that Sean's last statement.
I do know for a fact that being here in Fresno is a very large Latino population, this majority make. And I do know a lot of the Latino brothers have similar fears and issues with the police department, especially here, because there's a gang issue here in Fresno, and one of the gangs is a Latino gang called the Bulldogs, and the police commissioner has went on record that he's going to eradicate the Bulldogs from Fresno. And the only way he can really, you know, logically eradicate the Bulldogs from Fresno is through racial profiling, to find all Latino men between the age of 16 to maybe like 45 and harass them.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty much the only way he can eradicate them. Because unlike the gangs in other areas, especially like in Chicago, there's no structure as far as the Bulldogs are concerned. There's no structure. So there's no lieutenant, there's no captain, there's no foot soldier. It's just the Bulldogs, and they're just out there doing stuff. So the thing is that the only way he's been able to curtail a lot of the gang problem is by racial profiling. And and several of my students that's in my classes that take them on courses have, you know, told their narrative on how they've been harassed by the police officers. Unfortunately, I don't think it's because of their economics.
Mm-hmm.
It's because they're brown.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, so the thing is like, I can understand what Sean may be trying to say. I don't want to put words in his mouth, but I can understand what Sean may be trying to say. To me, is the whole argument of the pro-racial system, the new racial society, that race is not an issue. anymore. Hmm. I think as long as there are going to be human beings, race is going to be an issue.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look at, you know, unfortunately, when you look at situations of the helping professions, like when you look at the helping professions, like the social workers, psychologists, counselors, and if they have, we have biases in our profession. Teachers
absolutely
have biases in their professions because mm-hmm. we're human. So it's obvious to realize and understand that police officers will have biases. And by the, and unfortunately, those biases get people killed.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I don't know.
I think tonight this was a much-needed topic for us to discuss, and I'm sure we can continue to weigh in on this topic of divided states of America, racism in 2015. But in our last few minutes, I want to know what closing remarks would you guys have. Obviously, we are definitely not where we used to be as it relates to racism. And Dr. Raheem, you made reference to the type of racism that we're experiencing. And so even though we are not living in segregated cities and forced to use the back of the restrooms or sit in the back of the bus, we are definitely experiencing forms of racism in 2015. If we look just in right now in Texas, our students are getting ready to take the, I believe, the STAR test. And so even if we just look at our educational system, when we talk about a just and fair system, it really isn't. We're giving students across the state of Texas this standardized test, and we're expecting all students to do well equally, but yet you have some students that have laptops and iPads and tablets that they own and they take home every day, and all of their books are downloaded, and they have access to this material, and yet you have other students on the other part of the city that not only don't have books, but they cannot take their books home, and they don't even have access to computers in some cases. And so when you talk about living in a fair and just society, we're still not quite there yet. So many of the things that we talk about in reference to racism tonight, we know do exist in some cases and not in all. But I definitely think we have to talk about it. We would love to just kind of sweep it under the rug and act like it doesn't exist, but unfortunately it does, and it's impacting us daily, and it will continue to impact us and our children and generations to come. So, Sean and Dr. Raheem, I would like to know what are your closing remarks as we end tonight's show. What would you like to leave our listeners with?
Well, I always defer to the doctor. You know, my doctor, like I said, is off Bourbon Street, so I don't think that really counts.
Off Bourbon Street?
Don't even worry about it, Dr. Raheem. Don't even worry about it.
Leave that one alone. Okay. Again, I would say that unfortunately, I don't think things have improved at all. Not really. I think we're living in similar times. It's just it's more covert than it was overt. But we don't have the black and white water fountains. We don't have that you have to enter from the back of the bus or ride the back of the bus. We don't have the separate but equal in, to an extent, but we do have, unfortunately, the racism when it comes to many structures and institutions in this country. You mentioned education. I would venture out to the criminal justice system. So it's like the covert racism that's happening, and don't let me give you the impression overt racism is no longer happening. But one of your callers called in and talked about white supremacy. That's not gone; it's still there. And you can look at it in the media. You can look at it in the educational system. You can look at it in the criminal justice system. And the covert racism that is going on a regular basis causes more mental health issues among people of color than anything else, because it's a traumatic thing. And the accumulations of these microaggressions causes what I call racial battle fatigue, where you feel that you're in a constant battle because of your race. And oppression is a major traumatic thing that happens on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, Dr. Raheem. Sean, any closing remarks?
Yeah, not just as a doctor, doesn't have some valid points, but in the world I live in, I see people that love black culture. They're always going to be gatekeepers in any society, whether it be criminal, or in the educational system. You know, they're always going to be gatekeepers. They're always going to be obstacles in your way, but things are a lot better. You have opportunity that you never had before, the opportunities that your parents didn't have and your grandparents didn't have. So if you want to say that you never got anywhere because we live in a racist world, and that's your choice, but you're really selling yourself short.
Thank you, Sean, for your closing remarks. Thank you so much, Dr. Malik Raheem, for joining us tonight. I hope you'll come back and sit with us again. Thanks. As always, you guys, don't forget to Facebook it, tweet it, pass it on. Don't forget to tell a friend about Dr. Guy's Monday Night Gumbo. Everyone have a blessed and safe week. Good night.
Good night. Thank you, Dr.
Good night.
Good night.